At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Football on Off the Ball
with Sky. Don't miss Brentford versus Chelsea on Saturday Night Football, live on Sky Sports.
Football on Off the Ball is brought to you by Sky. All the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports. And a special treat for you today, I'm delighted to say we have the legendary Brian McClair in studio. I was going to call you a Celtic legend, I was going to call you a Man United legend, and I bottled it both and I just went for legendary.
Well,
how are you?
It's very kind of you to say so. I find it difficult at times when people talk you in such terms, but it's wonderful that people can still remember that what I used to do and what the situation for me is that I think I'm just a normal person who had an extraordinary series of occupations, or as I would call them, hobbies, that sometimes I got remunerated for.
Yeah, that's an amazing way of looking at it, because it always seemed from the outside that you didn't get too high or get too low by what was going on in football.
Well, no. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I suppose so. The whole idea of football.
Yeah,
no, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
The whole idea of football for me was to be an enjoyable part of it. Sometimes there were losing's probably the most obvious example of where you might get a bit down about it. But when winning is contrary to that. I think it's probably because of the way that I look. I mean, I'm not overt when it comes to displaying my emotions.
Why is that? Why is that something?
I just think it's just the way I am. I've been growing up, you know. I think a lot of the things is probably part of. I would rather than say it was a Scottish trait. I think it's more of a Gaelic trait, where you're always someone's always there to help you keep your feet on the ground. You know.
I mean, that's a polite way of putting it. To knock you
not so much of that, you know, because when you're early on, it's, you know, your dad was a better player than you, and eventually it was your sister was a better player, you know. So there's always that. Tempering of.
We call it begrudgery. You guys obviously have it too.
I don't say begrudged, you know. It's just my character, you know. But whereas. There actually is a party going on in my head at all times that I'm awake.
Right, well,
and even sometimes I'm sleeping as
that
well.
That is a good combination to have. It's kind of, you know, the veneer is different from what's...
Yeah, I like to think so, yeah. And occasionally you might see a glimpse of that.
Excellent. Well, hopefully we'll see a glimpse of it over the next 20 minutes or so. You're in Ireland at the moment. I'm going to tell everybody this to make sure. So last night you were in Cork. Tonight you're in Naoimh Finbarr's GAA Club in Cabra. Tickets are £25. They're on sale from SaoirseProMotionIreland.com. You're also going to be joined by Gary Ogue for a live performance, and €5 from each ticket goes to charity. And then I think tomorrow night you're in Belfast as well. So there's still an opportunity for people to go and get tickets. What's the show about? What are you doing? What? How does it work?
Well, really, it's somebody asking me questions and me reviewing my career. The reason why I do question-answer things rather than do a written down or recorded or memorised speech is that I don't really know what I'm going to say, and I like the idea of that people can tease something out of you, you know, from the audience, you know. I like people to be interact, so I think it's a much better occasion that they can be part of, that maybe a question that they might have wanted to ask. Maybe not just particularly me, but any particular person who'd been in a similar situation as me, and get a different answer to that question, maybe in every venue I'm at.
Right.
Because I tend to think about exactly what they've said, and something else might pop in, you know. So if they're asking me questions about my career, whether it's at Celtic, or when I played for Scotland, or indeed in the early days when I was at Motherwell, something might pop in that I'd forgotten about, you know.
So Motherwell, Celtic, Manchester United, and then you joined the staff at Man United. Is that what happened?
Yeah, yeah.
How long were you on the staff?
Well, I was blessed to have been in a position in the staff for 14 years.
Right, okay. And so what do you do now?
Now I spend my time wandering around doing a bit of cycling, watching television, reading, listening to music.
Is it nice?
Enjoying myself.
Is that nice? Because
everything I've done has been nice, you know. I mean, my brother Paul, for example, who gets very irritated by people who ask him what job that I do, and he just says he's never had a job. You know, so this is all part. This is an extension of the fact that I've never worked in my life. You know,
and are you enjoying it? Because like a lot
I love it. Yeah, I do love it because it I've always had the idea. I knew that it was going to finish. I had a good idea, and I didn't know the day it was going to finish. But right from the beginning of my football career, because the evidence suggested that if you got to 34 or 35 and still be playing football at a reasonable level and getting paid for it, then you'd had a good career and you were going to have to find something else to do post that. Now, I never thought that I would end up spending 14 years on the coaching side of the game, but it fitted in with what my idea of my other, well, when anybody ever asked me what I would want to do if I was a player, I always said a maths teacher,
right?
Because that was something I thoroughly enjoyed as well, and I ended up teaching football, which is not anything I considered while I was playing, but that was the second most rewarding part of being involved in professional football.
Right, and because so many people, particularly in your generation that didn't make the millions and millions and millions and millions of the people that came after you, struggled with the post-football life and struggled to find a place in the community that made sense to them.
I think that's always been the case all the way through, irrespective of how much they've got paid. You know, I think there's a really good book out that I can't recall quite the title of the moment, talking about the situation, particularly in respect to professional football players who very quickly post-career have difficulties in various different ways.
Financial, emotional,
all
relationships.
Yes, all that sort of thing, and it's quite incredible. I suppose trying to be... Maybe it's more difficult now because there's such a gap between them and the man in the street, or the person in the street, really.
Yeah.
And maybe they don't spend enough time getting reminded that where they came from, because nearly all of them will have come from exactly the same background.
You've started a podcast as well. That's obviously a way of keeping in touch with people and finding new things out and feeding your curiosity.
Well, one of the things about the podcast for me was that I had a friend who lost his job during lockdown, and he started then filling his time with wandering around his hometown. And I was thinking that it'd be nice to do something without it being trivialising life in the universe and everything. Can it be something that's entertaining, amusing, hopefully, and whatever people want to get out of it, and be a certain length that it would fit in to when my mate's going wandering around the streets of Coatbridge.
So he's your audience.
He's my audience. So I'm thinking
cool.
About him as the, well, he's fortunately he's been re-employed now, although he still listens.
So
to
you've
this,
no so. Audience anymore.
Yeah, so I've got an audience. Zero audience. Yeah,
but
so.
that's a really good thing to have, because it means that when you're telling jokes, you know he's laughing at them.
Well, yeah, you do. You think about people who you think they'll think these things may be amusing,
right?
And that's it's. I don't find it. I find it quite comforting to be able to do things and be able to chat to people. You know, again, it's outside my normal personality. You know, when I'm quite quiet, really, and I'd rather be listening than asking.
But actually, it's outside your personality in terms of the that part of it. But it sounds like you're curious about the world around you.
I've always been curious about that. Yeah, I've always wanted to know as much as you can possibly. Taken really from all sorts of different spheres. You know, I've not just been interested in football, I've been interested in how the world works, I suppose.
That bit about wanting to be a maths teacher, you did a degree, did you?
Yeah, I was doing maths, physics and chemistry, yeah.
Did you finish it?
Yes, yeah.
When, in Glasgow or?
In Glasgow, yeah.
While you were playing for Celtic?
Yeah, I finished it, yeah.
Right, and how was that? Because I think we've Pat Nevin on every week. I think you're good mates with Pat.
Yes, there's been rumours that Pat and I are.
Well, you're seems like kindred spirits.
The thing that's going to just reminds me of the beauty of the changing world with regards to Pat. Pat didn't go to university. Pat went to college.
Okay.
But it's a university now.
You're such
super.
That's a very niche joke, and again, you're broadcasting to an audience of one. But don't worry, we'll clip it for him and we'll send it to him to make sure that he gets it.
So it's a bit snobbish, really.
Well, 25 years later, you're still throwing shade over it, and it's landed. I can tell that he's sitting uncomfortably, getting angry.
Oh, he won't be getting angry about it.
Oh, he will. He will.
No,
he will.
I think there's many things that he could be outed about. That he probably get a bit mildly irritated. I actually don't think I've ever seen Pat angry.
But my point is, for you two to be footballers who were so well educated was not the norm at the time.
Yeah, but both of us were encouraged to continue to do what we're doing because our parents realised that outside our potentially ridiculous belief that no matter what was going to happen, no matter how well or how poorly we're doing in our schoolboy football, that we were going to be professional footballers, and that was it. But we were encouraged that always the things. My parents just said to me, in sense of courage, encouragement, and again, this is part of the being brought up in the west of Scotland, is there's always a potential drawback, you know. So my parents always say, you got to study because you might break your leg tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, that was part of the team talk.
Yeah, wear clean underwear, you don't know when you're going to get knocked over.
That's exactly the same situation about those kind of things. So there was this idea that, I think my mother said to me not that long ago, she didn't realise how much I loved football, you know, how much I was obsessed with football, you know, because, and ended up, both of us ended up doing that, but a byproduct of it is that we never stopped being curious or continue to be educated. Because, again, part of the thing as well is we knew that we were going to finish playing football.
Yeah.
So we wanted to be prepared to give us an opportunity to do something.
You needed a job.
But, you know, I didn't realise that I would be doing teaching football, and I don't know if Pat's dream was to be talking nonsense about football in media.
Well, he ran the club for a little while, so
he did do that very well. He ran the club, yeah, and they did very well at what he was doing. You know, unfortunately, the philosophy of him and the owner didn't match up in the end, and quite rightly, he did the right thing by leaving.
Were the football people that you were around in any way suspicious of the fact that you guys were educated?
Yeah, only in the sense that you would be prepared for it, and that you were weird. If you've read books and watched films with subtitles and listened to music that certain genre related. But when you're, again, you get hardened to that, and you end up participating in your own way when you're in dressing rooms, which Pat and I were in from we were 16 years of age. And you grow a bit of a rhino hide when it comes to criticism of yourself. And it allows you, in a way, to be able to give a bit of banter back often, and banter in the sense of, even particularly because it was, it's an example for me. I like to have enjoyment every day, I like to have a laugh every day. A lot of that time was spent at the, you know, using my teammates to entertain me by asking them questions that I knew they wouldn't know the answer to, or they would give me a lot of times a very short, banal, and a lot of the times ended in a two-word statement, second word being off. But that entertained me, that I had actually got them to think about something. They were like, you know, why are you asking?
Was this consistent,
question?
Or was it only when you kind of became a man?
No, it's always been the same thing.
Were you doing a Motherwellism as a teenager?
Oh yeah, you learn very, very quickly that this is, you learn that right away.
Well, I presume you get kicked and trained.
It didn't matter what you said. Yeah, it didn't matter about you. I mean, I think it was Paddy Creran's quote about one of the. A young player coming in, he says, I'm not interested in what your age is, son. You're either good enough or you're not. Mm. And if you're good enough or not, that's also to be part of what it takes to be a football player. And there would be certain parts where you'd be more respectful to the older player. But if they gave you a bit, then their expectation was that you were going to get a bit back. So.
And it was a test as well to see if you could survive in the environment.
Part of the same thing, of course, yeah.
It turns out you were pretty good.
Being ahead of the banter or?
No, at the football. when did you get? When did the penny drop for you that actually you were going to make it as a professional? And
I think that when you be at a professional football player, so when you're a professional football player for me at Motherwell, at Celtic, at Manchester United, I was surrounded by people who were professional football players who still reminded you every day that you had to work hard every day to maintain the situation you were in. So even all the way through, I never felt that, oh, this is me, I'm a professional footballer now. It's like every day you have to put the hard graft in.
When did you feel confident enough that you were at the right level, that the goals that you scored at Celtic, the goals you scored at Man United, this is the job for you and that you deserve it?
Yeah, I think when the manager's picking you to play in the team, that's when you feel confident that you can do something with regards to professional football player, that he's choosing you. So that I've always been clear about the only opinion that's ever important is that guy who picks the team.
Well, I'm trying to find the exact source of it, and I will find it, and I'll tweet out so I give the right credit. But there was a piece done yesterday about the lineups in Premier League history that were fielded the most often. I don't know if you've seen this.
No, I haven't seen it.
But the team that was picked the most often was your team in 93 that won the league, and you were in midfield. It started 19 games that season, and that's the most of any team in the history since the Premier League started, obviously. And
yeah,
the old First Division would have been quite significantly different. You know, famously, Forrest used 13 players or whatever that story is.
Yeah.
So you got picked a lot that season that Man United won the league. But the other bit of information in that, which I thought was really interesting, was that George Best scored 20 league goals in a season, and Dwight York scored 20 league goals in a season, and the only person to score goals at that level for Manchester United in a league season in between was you. When you arrived, you were a prolific striker, but when you get in the team that is the one that wins the league, you're a midfielder. Yeah. What's that transformation? How does that happen?
Maybe it happens because I was never a striker. I was made into a striker.
Were you not a striker at Celtic?
Yeah, but I was made into a striker. I never played as a forward until I was 18, 19.
Right.
And that was when I was at Motherwell. And I always loved scoring goals because that was one of the best things to be part of. So so scoring goals, so I was always scoring goals. But I was never a forward. And still to this day, I don't like playing with my back to the defenders. And you know, so I was always a midfield player who was a kind of became... one of the things I get... I was a football player and I think I could play all right anywhere. And several times I did play all right anywhere, depending on what the needs were of the team and what the request was from the manager. So playing midfield was more comfortable for me than playing up front.
So you were delighted when that conversation happened?
I was just delighted to be part of the thing. I think it allowed me opportunities to play. So your goalkeeper, you've only one chance to play, right? That's it, you're a goalkeeper. Some players can't play in other positions. I knew that I could play all right in other positions, and I did play all right in other positions. So they gave me, and I wanted to play. I love playing.
When you scored all the goals, when you're banging those in, yeah, at that point, is there not a little bit of you goes, I am a striker. Come on.
No, I just love scoring goals. That was the thing. It didn't matter where I was playing.
Now we'd be calling it a number 9 or maybe number 10 more accurately.
I think number 10 was what I enjoyed most.
Yeah.
So playing in between, yeah.
Yeah, and then pretty successful at it. And then
or whatever. Then. Systems come back into fashion, don't they? So when I first started playing football, the system would have been pre-4-4-2, so mine would have been an old inside forward,
right,
and an inside right, which they kind of gone back to now. So I would have said that I would have played in that position where you get an opportunity to get into the box.
Yeah, it is a forward position. It's
forward.
Not. Yeah.
But going forward, not looking at the ball, so you're back to the game.
Was it obvious that you were going to end up in midfield from in your mind? It was always going to happen.
No, because I just wanted to play. So when Alex Ferguson is asking you to play, this is where you're going to play, and he signs somebody who thinks this can do a particular job in a different position, you just have to accept that. When Eric Cantona came to Manchester United, I thought, I don't think I'll be here that long because he's going to be potentially playing in that position.
That was correct. He was going to be playing in that position.
Indeed, he did end up playing in that position, but it turned out that my view was wrong because I ended up still playing a lot of games.
How did that? How did Ferguson tell you you were becoming a midfielder?
He didn't tell you.
He just got picked.
Yeah.
Right.
He just trusted you to play in a particular position. If he picked you in the team, I was happy that he thought that I could perform in that position.
Because I saw the other day on TV the game against Liverpool at the end of the season the previous year when Leeds won the league, and it's actually quite a different team from the team that wins the league the next season, even though there's not a huge turnover in players, but there's some turnover in players. And obviously, yeah. Cantona's actually sitting on the couch alongside his Leeds teammates watching them win the league, TV pictures, and then obviously he famously joins you guys. That period where you're never quite sure if you're going to make it, what's it like in the United dressing room at that point? What's the devastation like after Leeds pip you that year?
Well, it's like anything, isn't it? When you get so close to something that has not been achieved by a Manchester United team, bitterly disappointed. However, a couple of things happen. You're the manager. After the last game said, I can't wait for the summer to be over and we'll come back to pre-season because I think we'll win it next year. This is what he's saying before we go away on holiday. The second sort of inspiration for me, and I think for some of my teammates, and the first time that he was inspirational in the Manchester United success was that Alan Hansen on Match of the Day said that Manchester United have blown their chance. They will never get as good a chance as this to win the first division.
Right. And I didn't know he'd done it twice.
Yeah, he'd done it. That was the first time he did it, yeah. And I thought to myself, nah, we're not having that. We're basically saying that we've bottled it or we're not good enough or whatever. And I was, and I'm sure a number of my teammates couldn't wait to get back for pre-season the following year. So you get inspiration from all sorts of different areas.
Hansen, your former Scotland teammate,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, I played with him a couple of times. Yeah, cracking, absolutely wonderful gentleman, yeah.
But good fodder for...
Yeah, very good fodder, yeah. Okay. And you've got to look at that sort of thing. And I'm sure that when you play football and you talk about football, you have to be... You're going to get things wrong, aren't you? Or, you know, when you're trying to suggest that what's going to happen in the future, you know. So.
You are going to get things wrong, right? But you're also, like, we do this brilliant football podcast called The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy, and Paddy's one of the Dublin Gaelic footballers who has won 7 All-Ireland titles, and every year they would need to find some chip to get them going. And he was like, and there was loads of invented things along the way, but he basically confessed that there's a madness involved when you're all in the cause and everything outside it is nonsense. Like Alan Hansen saying that shouldn't really be this inspiration to you group of grown men, but yet it is. There's a madness in that, isn't there?
I don't think there's any that things that ever change when it comes to... I think that the external criticism is probably the thing. Internal criticism, you accept that because there's an avenue for you to say back to your teammate. So when you're working within a group of players, you've got a chance to praise each other, you've got a chance also to criticise and to deal with that criticism, because normally it's very truthful and probably right. Externally, he's always been accused. Manchester United and Alex Ferguson was always siege mentality. It's all about us and everybody else is against you, and use that energy and that with comments in particular from those. And he used several of things that he'd overheard in his team talks to be inspirational, I suppose. Yes, and your point there, another thing is you want to win when you've got a flavour of winning. I thought that football was about winning. I've always thought that it was about winning. And winning, join yourself, but winning is the be all and end all, really. And they've got being allowed to give the best opportunity to win and win the things that are available, leagues, cups, that allows you to have not only the memories of it, but the memorabilia attached to that.
Take a knee and say, is it our father, they say, is it...
One of the hits.
I never understood why this isn't match fixing. If that's what's going on, then why is it not match fixing?
OTB AM, live, weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.
The wins for you guys came at important times. Obviously, you know, famously the story about the third round of the FA Cup and winning that and end up winning the trophy, but... Was winning the European trophy actually more important to you as a group in terms of the...
No, they were all as important and they were all celebrated in the same way and they were all commiserated in the finals that we lost also. So it was all about the chance to win the game and get another medal, another title.
So they all feed the confidence of the team that ends up winning the league.
Yeah, because you start believing that you're in a way that you're invincible as a group, and that together you can.
You were totally invincible, you know, in the previous year. So what is the tipping point in that confidence? That at the end of the season you don't lose games. In the commentary, you lose that game against Liverpool 2-0, and when Leeds win the trophy, and the commentary is essentially since Easter, West Ham beat you, Forest beat you.
Yeah, a lot of the things to be the rationale of how you analyse that in football and all sorts of sports are probably over analysed. We had to play an awful lot of games in a short period of time that is not right, really, but that was what was dictated at the time you got on with it, and the results didn't go our way. We, looking to the other way around, we got that close as I had been at Manchester United, and we felt that they were really very, very close.
So actually, what we would have seen as the outside, as here's a team that has crumbled under the pressure, what you guys are seeing, we're making progress.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the thing that we never know from outside.
Yeah, and you get that, well, same thing. You want to prove to people that you aren't those things that everybody's saying you are.
So you had the double whammy of Hansen saying you were never going to win it, and then Cantona arrives. So at the start of the season, how sure are you that you're going to be a mainstay in midfield? How confident are you?
No, you're never sure, because of the way that you're never sure. It's always about, are you going to get picked for the next game? You don't know, because a manager very rarely would come and say, well, he would never tell you you were playing the next game, because he would assume that probably quite rightly, that you would take it easier during the week and that he'd made an error in that. So everything was always, you were kept very much on your toes, that, you know, until he named that team, he never put the team up on a sheet of paper. When he walked into that dressing room, you didn't know you were going to be playing or not.
How does that feel when you're waiting for the paper for his hand to get out of the way so you can see it?
He just named the team, you know.
Oh, he actually said it out loud.
Yeah, so he named the team. He didn't. Right. He'd just come in and go. Or sometimes you knew you weren't playing because he would tell you before.
Right, that's.
So sometimes he would actually bring you into the office and say, and give you his view of why he was telling you you weren't playing. But he didn't just say you weren't playing. There would be several reasons why you weren't playing.
Is that season peak McLaren? Is that you at your best football?
Maybe, potentially.
Even all the goals before that, it's actually.
Potentially it could have been. Yeah, I don't look at each season and say, well, how was I then at that bit, and how was it at that bit.
I'm looking at the stats here. You played 42 games that season in the Premier League. That's every one. Like, a key member of that team that wins the league.
Yeah, I think you can say that was probably a crucial part of my football career, yeah.
Yeah. Go on, tell us. What does that feel like?
To be winning things and win the league at Manchester United for the first time in decades was wonderful.
Did you know the team was good enough? Like, at what point during the season does it hit you, right, this Cantona signing?
I think that there's certain moments. I think the moment for me was that there was three teams really that were challenging for the title that year, and that was ourselves, Villa, and Norwich. And we went to Norwich, and I think we probably played our best. Certainly first half of football in the whole season, and we kind of blew Norwich away, maybe even 25 minutes of fast attacking, counter attacking football. I think we won the game 3-1, and I think from then we just all felt that
this is it, we've got it.
Yeah, well, that we're well on the way to. So
it's Giggs and Sharp on the wings.
Kanchelskis,
right.
Yeah.
The team that starts the most is actually Giggs and Sharp on the wing.
I'm saying in that game in Norwich, it was Kanchelskis who played, yeah. So.
And Cantona and Hughes start most of the games together.
Well, when Eric came, he his first game, I think he was on the bench. So the first game, I think it was Sheffield Wednesday, I think he came on and scored.
Not a bad introduction.
But as soon as he comes, he was a good player and he worked hard. And all the stuff that had been written about, or you could find that was about Eric, was all about how he was a terrible person, a terrible influence and all that. But yeah, it was contrary to all of those things when he came to Manchester United. You couldn't get a more professional, nicer, more engaged person who wanted to try and win, or wanted to be part of a winning team. And it seemed to be just all fitted in with what we needed and what he needed. And he very quickly became a huge favourite with the support.
It strikes me that you guys were kindred spirits as well.
Aye. I mean, Eric's, again, a lot of sportsmen get a lot of criticism for not being enlightened. It's just that they didn't spend an awful lot of time paying attention at school. I didn't mean they're thick, you know.
No, they had other stuff.
There's other things going on that they were concentrating on and practicing becoming professional football players. Eric, I liked Eric because the stuff that he was talking about, I was envious of, because I couldn't be running about saying that I was this was one of my heroes was a poet, you know, and having Geronimo as a tattoo in your chest. And I just liked him being, because he's kind of quickly work out what people are like, you know,
yeah,
by how they behave and what they say in the dressing room.
Yeah.
And I liked him because he didn't say very much, but he knew everything that was going on. He knew exactly everything that was going on. So I could see that the kind of mischievousness to him as well as the good football player and all that stuff, I just thought was brilliant. I'd love to have been able to get away with the things that he said and his views on certain parts of football, you know.
The midfield in that era is unbelievably competitive as well. So that, I presume, is driving you on to greater heights as well. It's the external motivation, but the internal motivation is making sure that you're in that team when Ferguson names it in the dressing room.
Yeah, you need to have competition, and otherwise you're quite quickly the. You drop your performances. You need to have those internal, as you say, and external challenges. And
did you play mostly with
them?
Did you play mostly with Ince? So you're
mostly with Ince, yeah.
And who was your when you weren't named in the team? Who was getting?
Well, Brian Robson was still playing. It still come, even though Brian was coming. I think he left not long after that. But Robbo was still a fierce competitor and someone who you were. If you were picked in front of him, even then,
well, you're keeping him out of the team.
You were pleased, yeah. So yeah. And then Roy was going to go on to become a fantastic football player for Manchester United and the Republic.
What did your game? How did it evolve? How did you become a better midfield player around that time? What were you trying to?
Just be playing. It's all about players round about. Yeah, you play with good players, you become a good player. You know.
Today we would have. Well, I don't know how everybody would describe you and Ince as a midfield partnership. Like, who's the six and who's the eight?
Yeah, but that's all nonsense as far as I'm concerned.
Well, tell us why.
Because you should be able to play anywhere.
You sound like John Giles. We've got John Giles on every week talking to us.
You should be able to play. If you're a midfield player in particular, no matter what number or position you're talking about, you should be able to play in any of those positions. And maybe even you should play them during the game.
So you should be able to switch.
Ferguson expected you when you lost the ball for everybody to defend. Defending for him meant getting back into a shape. So you're back into the shape he wanted. So it was 4-5-1 as a defending shape. Irrespective of what part of the field you ended up in, and it didn't really matter. You get back in, you take the shortest route to get back into a 4-5-1 shape and stop. When the game changes, stops, there's a pause in the game, then you can get back into
your normal position,
the position that he's chosen. But he was confident that for those couple of minutes, that no matter where you were, you could play.
You knew what the role was.
Yeah.
And so what's the conversation like with Ince in the middle of a game about who's covering who? I'm going to go.
It's just you just know by playing with players and training with players when they're going to go. There's just by the way, here's a bit of paper I've just taken. Here you go, this is what I'm going to go and I'm going to do it on the 69th minute. It's nothing to do with that. It's to do with you know that he's off.
Yeah, because he likes to go.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, that was like, you were given the licence.
You can't both go.
No, but you give them the licence. Well, maybe you could if Giggs ain't sharpie. I'm not going, and it's their responsibility.
Both at that stage of their careers, not noted for their...
it doesn't matter about that, though. As I was saying, it's about bodies being in the position.
They just had to do what they were told.
That was, you just knew that's what you're doing. The understanding was, well, he goes, I've got to sit there a little bit.
Right.
And if, well, I wanted to go all the time because that was in my nature, because I want to be in the position of passing the ball to somebody to score, and I want to score. That was mainly my thing, you know.
Did you have a different relationship with Ferguson than other people, given that he understood where you've come from and who you were?
In comparison to any other managers?
Well, in comparison to other teammates. Like, because not everybody got invited to join the coaching staff at the end. That would suggest that there was some kind of level of...
I think you could see things in me and that I couldn't see in me, that, you know, with regards to being part of a coaching staff.
What, like?
That maybe that I would be all right at it, you know. Maybe I could impart the in a different way from how he coached, and that you coach your own personality, probably, really, but you're still getting the same message across. Maybe you could see that I would be, maybe part of it has been that you're every day you're getting judged on various different levels, maybe because I was pretty good with the younger players that came in and helping them, even though I knew that they would probably be taking my place. Just call me. I'm not doing it for you because it's going to be detrimental to my career. Maybe it could be all sorts of things like that. I think, yeah,
well, I think that's very interesting, because a lot of people in those positions are like, well, my job is just to win games. My job's not to do anything other than my job, as opposed to actually, I can help everybody here.
I didn't think that way, because he knew that it was, again, going back to the bit about the mortality thing with the guy's football player. I knew that I wasn't, you know, that the younger ones were going to be, they're certainly chasing you down, you know?
Yeah.
And if you're not on your shoulder, then they at some point, they would get past you. But I didn't see that as a thing that would say, well, how dare you? You know, they just knew that was part of what happened, and that I just wanted to hang in, or be there, maybe not sort of hang in, but be there as long as I possibly could.
Did you know that you were on the verge of tipping into this incredible period of success at the club? Could you see that stuff was trending in the right direction, that every part of the organisation was being revolutionised by the early success? Or was that as much of a surprise to you as it was to people outside?
I think that the overall thing, was a surprise, because you're sometimes a bit negative after you had the experience of when the year that Leeds won the league. You're always kind of working out how's it going to transpire as you travel through. But with regards to the team and the players, you could see them flourishing. And I'd been closer than some of my colleagues, because at that time I'd started to be sort of in and out of the team and been spending a bit more time training and playing with the reserves.
Right.
So I had a real feel. So, for example, I knew that Gary Neville had a long throw. Because I used to play golf. God, he can throw the ball far, you know. That was not what I'm saying. That was the only thing that Gary could ever do. But I remember Gary Parsley getting a hairdryer for not knowing that Gary Neville had a long throw. You know, it's one of the things that stick in your head. You know, as if it was like, and I'm like, of course, Gary, why would you not know that? And he'd never really played with him. And then training, because of the way the structure of training was, very rarely would it be an 11-a-side game and a practice match and training and that. So it's all small-sided game stuff. So, Gary, and you wouldn't have throw-ins when you're having small-sided games. So.
It's kind of an irrational thing to get the hairdryer about, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but there's probably loads of things that were irrational to get the hairdryer.
But it keeps everybody
important at the time, because the reason for it isn't necessarily about that particular incident. It's about saying, I really care about this, and I really care about this game, and I want to win this game. And you can do better than you're doing, in his opinion.
And here's the tiny little thing that I've picked
up. Here's a little thing that, you know,
you couldn't have known anyway, but it doesn't matter.
He couldn't have known, but I knew about it, which is a moment of amusement for me, you know.
Yeah, Pallister, everybody knows that.
Can't believe that I'm getting my ass kicked for not knowing that Gary Neville's got a long throw. I said, well, come on, Gary, you know, everybody knew that.
That's the bit that kind of strikes me about this, is that a lot of, I don't know, maybe again we're wrong, that everybody's a little bit on edge all the time. But actually, it sounds like you were enjoying this and being your full person. And this is like very rare that you go to work and you get to just be a true, authentic self.
I don't know about anything else. I can't really call it.
But you would know if you hadn't been given the opportunity to do that, right?
Yeah, and I mean, as I say, mine was all about, right, well, this is brilliant, what I'm doing. This is what I've dreamt of all my life, all my young life that I wanted to do. You don't know what it's going to be like until you're actually in there and doing it. And overall, it's great. So it was that thing about every day you're avoiding what people call work, which I still haven't managed to do any of yet. And it should be enjoyable. And I tried I've always tried to... I've told young players the same sort of thing. My whole thing was enjoy every day. Find something you enjoy during the day. You know, when I was coaching them, I wanted them... And I projected to them being players or when they didn't be players. Now, my sort of modus operandi was that I didn't want anybody coming back and says I didn't enjoy that.
Mm.
Or I hated training and I hated being a football player. It's because there's certain parts of it that I didn't like to do, and looking back and having more knowledge about it, I could see the reasons why these particular sessions were set up the way they were. But at times I was like, this is garbage, I don't want to be here today. And I wanted them all to enjoy it. Another thing is that you just don't know when it's going to stop. You know, it could stop for any reason. You could fall out of love with the game, you could have an illness, an injury.
Yeah.
You might not be in that particular club because of the opinion is that you're not the right player for that particular club, or you're not in form, or whatever it is, or it's down to your age. Just try and enjoy it as much as you can, because it really flies by.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be an enjoyable night for anybody who makes it to Finbar's GAA Club in Cabaret tonight. Tickets are £25 and they're on sale from SaoirsePromotionIreland.com. Brian McClare, pleasure spending time in your company.
Thank you very much.
Best of luck.
Thanks for inviting me.
Where does everybody get the podcast? What's it called?
The podcast is Life with Brian, and you can find it where you find all your favourite podcasts, and there is its own Twitter feed.
Well, enjoy. Brian, good stuff. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Don't miss Arsenal take on Crystal Palace on Monday Night Football. Live on Sky Sports.